The Natural Nurse with Ellen Kamai and Dr. Z, Mondays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome and Happy New Year to all the listeners out there tuning in for the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z program. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamperon, licensed naturopathic doctor and herbalist, professor at the University of Bridgeport, College of Naturopathic Medicine, and your host today. Dr. Kamai has the day off, and we have a great program today as I interview Dr. Peter Bongiorno, a naturopathic doctor and licensed acupuncturist in New York City. And Dr. Peter is vice president of the New York Association of Naturopathic Physicians. And before naturopathic medical school, he was a pre-doctoral fellow at the National Institutes of Health and Yale University. He's co-authored many medical journal articles in the field of neuroendocrinology and also many chapters in the textbook of naturopathic medicine. Also, textbook articles in psychiatric disciplines, including the biology of depression. And his book, which we're going to be featuring on today's program, which is called Healing Depression, Integrative Naturopathic and Conventional Treatments Using Naturopathic Medicine, Complementary Alternative Medicine, looking at new paradigms for depression, pathophysiology, assessing it, looking at the conventional and naturopathic protocols, lifestyle, nutrition, herbs, and things like that. You know, depressional disorders affect 10% of North American adults. And in a given year, about 25% of adults will have a major depressive episode. And particularly now that the holidays are done and people are trying to get back into the swing of things and things like that, that kind of euphoria, that situational euphoria may wear off and certainly end up with the doldrums of depression. I certainly see that in my office here in Connecticut. And it's projected that depression will be the second most burdensome disease after heart disease by 2020. Conventional medicine is great at prescribing medications for depression, but not well versed at addressing the causes of depression or preventing this disease. So this is where Dr. Bongiorno comes in and his great book. So welcome, Peter. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Dr. Z. It's great to be here, and thank you to everyone listening. Happy New Year.
Thank you, yeah. Well, let's start from the beginning. When we look at depression, let's backtrack and talk a little bit about naturopathic medicine, which has a unique viewpoint of diseases, and tell us a little bit about your first experience with clinical depression.
Right. Well, to tell you the truth, my very first experience was at an affective disorders unit. I was doing research at Yale University in the early 90s, and I had worked with a lot of men. It was in a locked affective disorders ward, and I had seen many men who had come back from the Korean War and different military situations and were just not doing well. Many were depressed. Many were on drugs. Many were drinking alcohol, and I just found it really fascinating in general how some people can come back from a stressful situation and be reasonably balanced and figure out a coping mechanism to move through, where others of us, we get stressed and we shut down or we get a lot of anxiety or both and different things happen to us, and then we need different ways to self-medicate to kind of get through. And that was the first time I had worked with it. Then I went down to the National Institutes of Mental Health, which is a big government facility down in Bethesda, Maryland, and worked specifically on what they call the neuroendocrine system, which is the nervous system and the hormonal system. and studied a bit about how depression affects that system in the body, or how that system in the body affects depression. And finally, after naturopathic school, starting a practice in Manhattan, interestingly, what I found is that there are many people, in fact, most of us, walking around on antidepressant medication, and sure enough, antidepressants are the leading cause of medication. And what I had seen when I started my practice in Manhattan about 8 years ago is that at some level, most people were on antidepressant medications for something, and that it didn't have to be war and that kind of experience to cause stress in people to allow their bodies to kind of shut down, that just everyday life seems to be helping people lose the nutrients they need to be healthy, causing people to not live the healthy lives they want to live, whether it's exercise or get to sleep on time and eat the foods they want to eat, and that even though maybe we're not living through war, and of course I don't understand what that's like because I've never been through it, I do think the day-to-day life for many people can cause people to shut down and create the kind of anxiety and depression that can happen in people who go through such difficult situations.
Well, I mean, we're living in, supposedly the war on terrorism, according to George Bush.
Right.
So, and
yep.
That kind of keeps people in a hyper-vigilant state with
yep.
all the
absolutely.
Threats and whatnot. That certainly can help. And then, many factors of modern life that's creeped yep. into our existence. Having 12 email accounts and putting all your information on Facebook and having, text messages coming at you every second of the day. I don't think that we're kind of used to these things, and I think that kind of overwhelms people maybe.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because when I was doing research, the animal model for depression, so to study depression, you do animal models, meaning you figure out ways to create diseases in animals the way they would be in people. And the way you create the animal model of depression is you subject the animal to random schedule of events and stress. So in other words, they don't know what's coming when, and they don't have a lot of control over their lives. And, it's funny because I speak in medical schools all the time, and I remember... last time I spoke at Mount Sinai School of Medicine, I had had a slide that talked about that animal model of depression, and one of the second-year students raised her hand and said, "Wait, that's what we're going through." So, and I don't think it's just medical students. I think it's pretty much everybody. We have really hectic lives, and we're doing a lot of different things. We don't feel like we have control. And I think in many ways that's contributing to the, emotional issues that are going on.
Yeah, I know in the Ayurvedic model from ancient India that increases what some Ayurvedic practitioners have talked about is vata-genic, vata meaning the air and ether constitution, these things. It's interesting because he even pointed out on another program I did a while back that even air travel, traveling in the airports, all this, getting all the electromagnetic bombardment is all, it was all predicted kind of by the Ayurvedic sages that it would kind of lead to this vata-genic or, but interestingly enough, that I would think that leads to anxiety versus depression. So can you define that, like how people can have both? Because it seems almost like, to the average person, it seems like an oxymoron. It's like if you're anxious, you're nervous.
Right.
And
yeah.
how are you depressed then? I thought depressed people are all kind of, woe is me, and I have no purpose in life, and they kind of are like Eeyore, sort of negative on Winnie the Pooh. So can you contrast those conditions and see how they can simultaneously exist in people?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, and I don't think anyone fully knows the answer to that question. My sense of it is that people have very different constitutions. And even among different people, I think depending on the day or the hour, their body may or may not have the wherewithal. I've heard very unscientific descriptions suggest that anxiety it's kind of what happens first.
Mm.
You get stressed out, you get anxious, and then as your body is pouring out all those adrenal hormones, all those stress hormones, little by little you get to the point where your adrenal glands just sort of poop out and your body gets tired, and then you sort of go into this depression. So some people would consider it a continuum, where it really, in some level, starts out with anxiety, and then over time, people just start to get depressed.
Mm.
But there are many people who have these periods where they're depressed, and then periods where they're anxious, or periods where they're anxious while they're depressed. So I don't think, I don't think there's any one person who's purely one or the other. At least it's pretty rare. And it's interesting because, you know, when you look at the medications that conventional doctors and psychiatry uses, they use very identical medications for both anxiety and depression. So it tells us that we don't really fully understand what's going on.
Right. Now, they look at it from that biochemical billiard ball type of idea when there's so many other factors, you know, not to knock what they're doing. But now, certainly depression affects lots of Americans, but you pointed out in your book in Chapter 1 that it seems like it's a pretty much a global phenomenon.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said earlier, the World Health Organization had mentioned that by 2020 it will be the second most burdensome disease, meaning that it won't kill the most people, but it will affect the most lives. It will cost, that much, the most money. It will cause other illnesses to be worse. And it'll be second only to heart disease in terms of burden on the world. So, yeah, many other cultures, many other countries. I think in North America we're in a place where we're starting to talk about it more. And I think in many other countries, let's say Asian countries, for example, there's still a lot less discussion about it. But I think it is certainly something that's a major factor in all countries and all health systems. It's certainly a burden.
Well, a lot of people self-medicate themselves with, various things from, herbs and Polynesia, the folks that frequent the kava bars I have Irish heritage in me, and, a lot of my relatives, they drank when they felt any, to kind of either numb themselves to what they were feeling or whatever. And, some of these were kind of socially accepted things.
Yeah.
And then even amongst sexes, men tend to stuff things more than women. As you know, probably your practice is mostly women. I know that for me.
Right. No, absolutely true. It's interesting. There's a lot of studies about Anglo-Saxon and Irish populations, and it seems like there is actually a deficiency of an enzyme in the body of many Anglo-Saxon origin people, and it seems like that when you drink, it allows an increase of these prostaglandins that actually help you feel good temporarily.
Right.
And that's, they think, one of the reasons why people of that heritage tend to drink a little more.
Right.
But it's been shown that actually if you give something like a gamma-linolenic acid or a borage oil or even primrose oil or something, that you can help that metabolic deficiency so that people tend to drink less. And actually I've seen that. In fact, I'm working with a woman right now. She's a Russian origin, but seems to also have that deficiency. And the borage oils actually helped her drink a lot less, and now she's able to work on the mood issues a lot more.
Wow.
As a result. So it's really fascinating.
Now, this goes back, into antiquity. And in Chapter 2, you talk about depression through, it was recognized by the Ebers Papyrus, one of the oldest medical documents. And it's interesting that they associated it with the heart, sort of like what they do in Chinese medicine.
Yep.
The heart is the seat of emotions, not just the physical heart, but the emotional heart. And then Hippocrates talked about it as melancholy, as part of the four humors.
Yeah,
so it seems like history has looked at this quite interesting. I even remember Culpepper from Culpepper's Herbal in the 1500s saying, drink lemon balm tea, Melissa.
Yeah.
Melissa makes the heart merrier and driveth away all melancholy thoughts. So people have been depressed for a very long time, that's for sure.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's definitely not something new. I would guess, though, that it's something that's definitely gotten worse over time, you know, as the burden on our lives, I think, have increased. But it is something. In fact, Hippocrates, you know, I think in many ways he was one of the original naturopaths, of course, and, you know, right. He treated it with what they called water therapies. He said water allays lassitude. You know, he would use water therapies, having people go into different types of baths. He would change people to usually a mostly vegan diet.
Mm.
He would make sure people got sleep. He would make sure people got exercise. And he used St. John's wort. So, you know, brilliant remedy, you know, multifactorial treatment there. And I think in many ways this is what we need to do today. And I think this is where I think modern naturopathic medicine and good integrative care comes into play, because, you know, what we need to start doing is think about the underlying causes. Depression isn't merely a Prozac deficiency. It's many, you know, neurotransmitters may play a role, and they can help sometimes, but they're certainly not the only player in mood. There's many, many players in mood, and the more systems we can work on and achieving optimal optimization of those systems in our body, the better chance we have at staving off this mood disorder.
But depression seems to affect many aspects of life. For instance, you know, certainly behavior,
mm-hmm.
you know, from suicide, from serious depression to catatonia to affecting sleep and work activities, fatigue, you know, to even agitation, weight gain, eating. I mean, there's so many. It really affects. It's really a holistic illness. It affects the whole being. It's just not the neurotransmitters you're saying.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, in a sense, I wrote a book on depression. In one way, that's absolutely ridiculous, because, you know, the word depression, it doesn't mean anything. It just describes how somebody's feeling. It doesn't tell you anything about what's going on or what the underlying cause is. And when you think about natural medicine, you know, I remember when I was in school years ago, they always taught you don't treat the disease, you treat the person. And my hope is that this book kind of expands upon different underlying issues to help treat that person, and in the process help the mood get better.
So you start talking about the pathology of depression, and it's interestingly you start with talking about the gut, which is a very naturopathic concept. You know, I remember even Dr. Mitchell and some of my, you know, the sages of naturopathic medicine saying, when in doubt, treat the gut. What does the gut have to do with depression? It sounds kind of crazy,
sure.
But
yeah, no, it does sound kind of off. You know,
right.
The gut and the brain are so far away from each other. What do they have to do with each other? Well, the truth is, I mean, and this is something we've known for decades. You know, we'll talk about neurotransmitters for a second. Most of the neurotransmitters are actually made in the digestive tract. There's these cells called enterochromaffin cells that actually balance serotonin and make serotonin. In fact, they're working on drugs that work on blocking serotonin to help irritable bowel patients. I just read this yesterday in a psychiatric journal. So even the psychiatrists know that those neurotransmitters are made in the digestive tract. Why the link isn't created, saying, okay, if you want to work on somebody's mood, then you need to get their digestive tract healthy. But it just stands to reason that if people are having normal bowel movements and they're creating the enzymes they need and they're breaking down their food, they're also going to have happy enterochromaffin cells that are going to be making proper amounts of neurotransmitters. There's a book that came out by, I think the fellow's name is Gershon, about two decades ago called, you know, the second brain. And what he's talking about is the digestive tract and all the nerves and things that go on in the digestive tract that really affect us the way the brain works in a similar fashion.
So when people are depressed, they have certainly a lot going on with their gut. There's, but then that can affect and cause inflammation, or is the inflammation causing the problem with the gut? Because I know when people have, for instance, a lot of stress, many times people come in my office and they have irritable bowel syndrome, mm-hmm. which is another one of those, wastebasket diagnoses. But clearly there's a link. When they get all stressed out, their bowels and stomach are erect, they can't digest their food, their appetite's gone, and that leads to a vicious cycle of calling in sick from work, missing school. I find this a lot, and it's interesting. Groups of teenage girls, I've been seeing quite a number of them with digestive problems and headaches and they go through batteries and batteries of exhaustive gastroenterological examinations and differential diagnosis type work, and the doctors can't find anything wrong with them. And
right.
yet they still have a lot of pain, and it has to do, I think, with this whole gut depression connection.
Yep, absolutely. And, you definitely hit on another aspect of the digestive tract. Most of the immune system is in our digestive tract. So most of the immune system in our body is actually located in that digestive tract. And when we're not digesting well and things aren't broken down, a lot of inflammation is created there. Now, one of the things I talk about in the book is that there's a lot of research now about inflammation in the gut corresponding to inflammation in the brain. And that inflammation in the brain seems to be a driving force in depressive disorder as well as other emotional disorders.
Yes, I have some patients that have had high what's called kynuric acid,
mm-hmm.
which it's a little beyond our scope today to talk really in depth of that, but basically you can explain it better than I can. These folks are taking tryptophan, and
mm-hmm.
instead of making healthy serotonin, they're making like a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. They're making a Mr. Hyde chemical, which causes neurotoxicity. Maybe you can go into that briefly.
Right. I talk about the kyanine pathway in the book, actually, in the pathophysiology section. And it's, like you said, it's a little bit on the complicated side, but the basic idea is that when there's a lot of inflammation and this kyanine pathway sort of gets activated, there's these receptors that basically, when we can block the kyanine, we tend to get more protection in our body. So when inflammation is blocked and serotonin levels are healthy, there tends to be what they call more neuroplasticity, meaning the brain is healthier, it can function better, it repairs better. And then when there's a lot more what they call pro-inflammatory mediators, which basically are generated by inflammation in the gut and other areas, the serotonin levels tend to get lower. There's a lot more, there's a chemical called glutamate in our body that gets released that's kind of neurotoxic in our brain. And so all these things sort of play a role around each other, the gut and the brain and tryptophan and serotonin and inflammation and kyanine, and it helps decide whether there's going to be repair and healthy nervous tissue or neurotoxicity and nervous tissue that's inflamed and breaking down. And of course, when it's inflamed and breaking down, that's going to cause a lot more mood problems.
So basically, digestive imbalances lead to these inflammatory chemicals, which then can cause inflammation in the brain, which then can lead to depression and other maladies, I would assume, mood disorders.
Right, exactly.
How do you treat that? Like, how would you approach someone that where you check, like, say, their organic acids? Like you could detect these in the urine. I know that for a mm-hmm. fact, because I've done that in many patients and seen these chemicals high. What do you do?
Well, it depends on the person, and I think a good doctor wants to just take a very long history
mm-hmm.
and find out, what their day is like, what they're eating. I mean, one obvious example is foods we eat. Some foods can be more pro-inflammatory for some people.
Mm-hmm.
So working on their digestion, working on them relaxing when they eat, Mm-hmm. So they break down the food. Maybe they're eating food that's perfectly healthy, but if they're not in a relaxed state or eating in the car or eating on the run, then they're not going to break it down properly, and that's going to increase inflammation in their body.
I know one kid was eating a lot of, Doritos, right, or some of these chips, which had a lot of MSG in them, and they were getting all kinds of gut and headache issues. And, you know, we've heard of the Chinese restaurant syndrome for a long time, but I think that was integral to try to teach them that the junk food that they ate led to changes in their moods and behavior and headache pattern.
Yeah, well, that glutamate is the glutamate toxicity I was mentioning before, and that kyrenine pathway, absolutely. And that's just one of many examples of, I think, the foods that really our bodies are not designed to take in. There's a lot of wonderful studies about that came out of Spain about a year and a half ago regarding the Mediterranean diet being wonderful to prevent and treat mood disorders like depression, and it seems like it's because it's such a wonderful anti-inflammatory effect. You know, the fish, the olive oil, the fresh vegetables. It's basically, what your grandmother told you to eat probably makes sense in terms of lowering inflammation. Getting enough sleep is really important because your body can't clear the inflammation if you don't have time to repair and heal and fix things. So that's, I think, especially important. Exercise, again, I'll probably mention exercise 1,000 times. Exercise is wonderful because it helps get that lymph system moving and that immune system to clean out. And if you're drinking enough water, you'll move all that inflammation out. So that can be a very important part of kind of de-inflaming. Things have to be done according to a person's ability. So there's some people who can do heavy exercise and some people who need to do more gentle work. But at some level, everybody needs to be moving their body.
And then, of course, there's quite a number of environmental toxic things that we find. You talk a lot about, in your book, certain heavy metals, which is funny. I'm doing a lecture at the end of the month in my own community here about, do people know how much metals are in their body? I mean, this is a...
Yep.
To naturopathic doctors, this is of integral importance. It's not even looked at in conventional medicine to even assess regularly your exposure to heavy metals.
Yeah, well, those metals are very neurotoxic. It seems like out of all the organ systems in the body, the nervous system is the most vulnerable to those toxins. And it's definitely a key, for many patients, especially when you see people who you're trying all the other good things, can be helpful, and you still see they're not getting better. I absolutely recommend people look into that as a possibility and something to work on. And then, if they have clear exposure, then that's probably something you even want to start with right away if you know that there's exposure and you do the test.
They might not even know. They might live near a highway, for instance, and may not know that they've been exposed to lead, or maybe they're... house has a lot of mold in it. These are all things that have kind of come up over the many years I've practiced that have certainly led to depression.
Yeah, I'm looking up in an office building here in Manhattan on Fifth Avenue in the Union Square area, and I'm looking at some of the vents that are coming in through the ceiling right here, and you see all this black dirt around it. I mean, you don't have to live near a highway or some kind of... a chemical plant. You just have to live in the Northeast, you're gonna have some of it in your body.
Now, why do they say that? Sometimes you watch the TV commercials and they say depression hurts, and they have new medications to handle the pain associated with depression.
Mm-hmm.
So depression can manifest in pain syndromes too.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we're talking about inflammation, and inflammation upregulates your ability to feel pain. So, there's definitely people who have depression tend to have more pain, and people with depression tend to have more fibromyalgia, which is another word that doesn't really mean a whole lot. But, the interesting thing is about all these new medications that come out. I mean, there are scores of medication for depression now. And, and a good way to know whether... I think conventional medicine knows how to treat a condition, it's to see how many drugs are for it. And there are so many drugs for depression because none of them really work. In fact, if you look at the history, up until 2008, most of the journals cited about a 70% effective rate for antidepressants. And that was considered generally true. And then in 2008, the New England Journal of Medicine came out with a series of articles talking about how a lot of antidepressant studies weren't published because they were negative, and that even the published studies were being skewed.
Mm.
So this fellow named Fournier looked into this further, and he published what was called a meta-analysis. So he looked at all the studies again over time, and they published this in the Journal of the American Medical Association, which, you know, as you know, is the major journal of all conventional medicine. This came out in January of 2010, and about a year ago now. And what it stated was that antidepressants do not work any better than placebo in mild to moderate depression, which is the vast majority of prescriptions being used. And that only in severe depression, like those suicidal type cases, did it seem to have an effect. Mm. So what that's teaching us is that as new drugs roll out, it's because the other ones weren't really working that well anyway, or the patents are going out, so they're trying new things. Now you would think that once that came out, the conventional world would say, okay, we have to come up with something different. Now, these new guidelines were just put out for major depression and depressive episodes in October by the American Psychiatric Association. And basically, they're still towing the line about using these drugs as first-line therapy. I just read an article that talked about it, and it said, and in treatment-resistant cases, exercise might be a reasonable add-on.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm thinking, well, maybe we should do it the other way. Maybe we should do the exercise first, and then if that doesn't work, and I think that's where natural medicines can come in, because we don't have one tool, we have many, many tools.
Right.
And I think probably no one tool by itself does the job either. But I right. think when we use them together and really get to know the person we're working with and pick the right group of tools, I think the effect is just really wonderful, and we can do a lot of good and help a lot of people feel better.
So what nutritional things have you found when we look at depression? There's got to be a whole plethora of different things that are mm-hmm. in balance in people. I know it's individual, but certainly there's got to be some commonalities that you see in your practice amongst people when you're trying to find the underlying cause of the disorder.
Sure. Well, I definitely like to run a number of blood tests with people. I remember the first time, I remember when I was a student many, many years ago, I was still in school, and a woman came in and to come see us at our clinic there in Seattle, and she had come in because she had a lot of menstrual problems. And on her history was that she was depressed, and I remember, I wasn't even a student. I was just an observing student, basically, what they call the secondary clinician.
Right.
And the supervising doctor, who I had a report to, basically said, well, we should run her iron levels and see how she's doing with that. And so they ran iron levels. They found out her ferritin, which is the iron storage. Many, many times doctors only run serum iron. Mm-hmm. They don't check the storage. And they found her storage is very low. They had put her on iron, and within a month and a half, she stopped using the antidepressant because she felt fantastic, and actually her menstrual issues also got better. So in this woman's case, it seemed like her iron was really low, which, makes sense, because when your iron is low, you can't really carry oxygen the way you normally would, and that's going to make you feel tired, and some people, when they feel tired, kind of manifest as low mood.
Right.
So that's just one simple example.
How about vitamin D? That's been in the news quite a bit.
Right, vitamin D, absolutely. Vitamin D, I talk a lot about vitamin D in the book. Some people call it the happy vitamin. You know, I think vitamin D works in a few ways. You know, as we know, when we get the sun, people are typically happier when they get enough sunlight. And part of that might be because of the conversion of vitamin D that we have in our skin, which is necessary. There's also, vitamin D also balances the immune system. So it's probable that there's also a lowering of inflammation in the body. I know we use vitamin D for autoimmune disease when there's too much inflammation. And I think vitamin D also applies for inflammation that's found in mood disorder as well.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. I hear the music. That's our signal to take a quick break, get some nice tea, Dr. Buongiorno, and take a quick breather, and we'll be back with more of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Don't touch that dial, folks. Stay tuned.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hello. Check out my show, The Animal Magnet Pet Radio, live every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern on Progressive Radio Network. Or catch it anytime you like by scrolling through the archives. You'll hear me, Deborah Wolf, best-selling author and award-winning radio host, chatting with the best pet experts and animal A-listers in the world about controversial topics like breed bans, the indoor versus outdoor cat debate, and whatever else is hot in the news and on their minds that matters to animals and the people who love them. Plus, we tell pet jokes, we'll give you trivia and smart, quirky facts, recipes, and take-home tricks and tests, homework your pets will love. Email your pet problems to me and we'll solve them on air. So listen to The Animal Magnet on Progressive Radio Network and get your animal fix.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
This is Adam Kolker from the Brooklyn Jazz Underground. We're going to be hosting a weekly show every Tuesday at 5 p.m., focusing on sounds coming from the borough of Brooklyn. We'll be playing some new releases, doing live interviews, some live performances, maybe even venture out into music from some of the outer boroughs. Brooklyn Jazz Underground, Tuesday at 5, only on the Progressive Radio Network.
What will be the impact of the Tea Party on the upcoming midterm elections? Who are these Tea Partiers? Are they really only a bunch of right-wing rednecks? Listen in every Thursday night from 7 until 8 Eastern to A More Perfect Union as your host, Bill Thompson, gets the inside stories from actual Tea Party players. Call in with your comments and questions, challenge guests, or show support. A More Perfect Union, Thursday nights, 7 until 8, only on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
This is Glenn Ford. Join me and co-host Nellie Bailey every Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for Black Agenda Radio, an hour of news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. That's Black Agenda Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
And we're back with more of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, your host, and I'm interviewing Dr. Peter Buongiorno, who is a naturopathic doctor, licensed acupuncturist in New York, and he is the author of Healing Depression, Integrated Naturopathic and Conventional Treatments. And I'm really excited to have him on here, and we're talking about nutrients that are instrumental, sort of the A to Z nutrients that we need to look at and prove and document that patients are low in, and of course maybe use those therapeutically. So we were talking about vitamin D Dr. Bongiorno, and I think we kind of cut you off there. So any last comment on D?
No, that's about it. I think D is just, an amazing mood vitamin. I would say, people shouldn't just start taking high doses of it. They really should get their levels checked, and that should be the 25-IOH serum. D should be checked, and based on that, you can start on a program. What we're finding is most people are quite low in vitamin D. But just by chance that somebody is borderline or high, it's good to just get your levels checked before you start taking a dosage. And what I do find is some people can take moderate doses, meaning 2,000 IUs twice a day, and not really gain much in terms of an effect, and they need to take much higher doses, likely because they have some sort of genetic defect that doesn't allow maybe absorption of it. And they can take much, much higher doses, whereas other people can take reasonable and moderate doses, and it goes quite high quite quickly. So it is something that should be checked and monitored, just so people get the right dose.
Now, one thing I've looked at quite extensively and even took some postdoc training in is amino acid therapy, which are usually associated with normal neurotransmitter levels, and amino acids provide the body with building blocks to maintain healthful levels when deficiency. But I find it's very interesting that the medical establishment doesn't really ascertain the patient's levels of these amino acids prior to prescribing medication. And, I've talked to a couple of them, a couple of local guys in my town, nice guys, but they say, we don't know of any reliable ways to ascertain the amino acids in the brain, and they don't think that there's a link between what's going on in the bloodstream or the urinary amino acids or the salivary amino acids and what's going on in the brain. But I believe there's evidence to the contrary, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, before... Amino acids are definitely something that needs to be discussed when working with a patient with mood issue. Amino acids are the precursors of all these wonderful neurotransmitters that help our mood stabilize and help us feel good. Even before amino acids, I always do like to think about some of the other vitamins like, B6 and the B vitamins and magnesium and all these other things that are also cofactors to help those amino acids become the neurotransmitters they need to become. So that's one issue. Because sometimes when we look at those tests and we find that they're low and that they're off, sometimes if you just give the body the nutrients it needs to make them properly, then it'll do it anyway. In other words, it knows how to do it. It just maybe is a little deficient in the things it needs to do.
Yeah, so that's a very good point. So, I would think that somebody that had a low serotonin or melatonin, which is a derivative of that, would perhaps be low, maybe are low in that actual amino acid. Maybe you can document that scientifically, but certainly looking at the, like you said, the nutrients that are needed to turn those amino acids, which theoretically we're getting in our diet. Even vegans and vegetarians, there's amino acids in plant food. I think there's a big misconception that plant food doesn't have any amino acids. But, we look at the great apes and ungulates and animals that are vegetarian, and they're getting their amino, they're building, it's funny, guys, we eat meat, but these animals are vegetarians. Yeah, they have special stomachs to derive the and cleave the plant foods to get the amino acids, but clearly if we're eating the meat and they're eating the vegetables, then clearly vegetables have amino acids. I find it interesting that people don't think that.
Yeah, now there's some good-sized animals out there, so they have to be eating something of substance.
Exactly. So, and then sometimes, but maybe it's absorption, like maybe there's a compromised absorption of these amino acids. I found carnivorous, patients, omnivores, but mostly carnivorous patients, I would call them, because these are meat and potatoes people, with very low amino acids, Peter, and then also vegans with very low amino acids. And the only thing I think of is, like you were saying before, when in doubt, treat the gut. Look for absorptive issues.
Absolutely. Yeah, that digestive tract is just a key to a lot of this, because if it's not working properly, the secondary routes to get things to the brain and make those neurotransmitters, and even to detoxify it, because the liver is cleaning a lot of the toxins out, that's not going to be working well either. So you have more toxins in the system, less good nutrients. So I know us naturopaths, we sound like a broken record, right?
But it's true, because the intestines, you absorb quite a number of things from the intestines too, and as well as being able to get, I look at it as the body's built out of minerals, vitamins, water, amino acids, and fats, and those are like the basic building blocks of our tissue and our body. So we have to start there and start with the building blocks and not build the house on sand. Build it on solid ground. But this sort of is still way away from percolating into medicine, as they're just looking at the latest pharmaceutical to treat depression, not starting with foundational things.
Right. Well, there's an old saying, Einstein said, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. and I think that's what we're doing with that. Like I said, I think there are definitely times when a medication can save a life.
Right.
I think in the suicidal cases and really difficult cases, the truth is, if someone is feeling that bad, it's probably not a good time to try to get them to change their diet. They're just not going to be in a place to do it. But I think once you're past that that difficult stage, I think the natural medicines have so much more to offer and can really help create this underlying this need to change the underlying issues that are causing the problem.
Yeah, because it's just not a substitution. We're not just substituting St. John's wort or ginkgo or an adaptogen like rhodiola, or even 5-HTP, tryptophan, 5-hydroxytryptophan, for a SSRI drug. It's a lot, from the interview here, it seems like it's a lot more involved in trying
Absolutely.
To look at.
And I think when you're looking at all the underlying issues, I think something like a 5-HTP or St. John's wort or a SAMe can be brilliant. I saw a fellow who came in this morning. I tend to use SAMe, especially with the older populations. And I find it's very helpful because it is a good methylator. It really helps certain aspects of the cardiovascular system, and it seems to be very helpful in mood, especially in older adults who maybe aren't methylating quite as well as the younger people are. So I think nutrients and herbs and things are fantastic adjuncts to help people feel better and kind of get them in balance a little quicker. I also use a lot of acupuncture in a similar fashion. I think that's also very helpful.
Yeah, I like your chart here. This is a very wonderful acupuncture chart where, you talk about the mind disorder and the particular point that's associated with acupuncture, and not that people would go around sticking themselves with needles, they'd have to go to an expert like you, but it's fascinating that the Chinese developed actual emotional issues and various points. It's not just acupuncture is just not used for physical pain, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
No, not at all. It's definitely a misconception we have in this country that it's more of a pain treatment. It's absolutely an internal medicine treatment. And I think depression, people who have depressive disorder can do really well with acupuncture to help them feel better, help them get more balanced. It's wonderful for anxiety as well. And it's interesting because the acupuncture points in traditional Chinese medicine are actually named for spiritual reasons. So they're actually, at first and foremost, a spiritual point. And then secondly, it works on the physical realm. That's how I learned them and how I understand them.
Yeah, like on page 260, 261, you have this great, for instance, when the lungs are in balance from excessive grief and from loss, that can cause a type of depression, but that's going to be treated by using lung points, whereas if someone has anger,
right,
melancholy, other types of issues that are leading to depression, maybe they got canned from a job and they're feeling very angry at the boss and they're contemplating, you know, hurting themselves and others, hopefully not, but, and there's different points that you would use versus somebody that's got fear and anxiety and versus someone else who's got menopausal symptoms and are depressed because their hormones are all topsy-turvy. So I like
exactly.
that it's that these emotional disorders are certainly looked at in a holographic way with Chinese medicine, acupuncture, and Chinese herbs, which I know you do.
Yeah, and I think that's where you know, Chinese medicine and natural medicines shine. You really kind of look at the person and the condition, and you try to figure out for them, you know, what's really going on, because it really is a different treatment completely, in that sense. And I think that's something, again, that the conventional medicines don't really do so well, because they don't really differentiate among the different constitutions and people that are out there. Maybe in the future they might, but right now it's sort of a hit or miss kind of way. Whereas I think the Chinese medicine is just brilliant. You know, that's one of the nice things about learning Chinese medicine.
Mm.
You walk in and you pick up a book like this, and it has basically work of thousands of years of
right.
of scientific observation that people you know, figured out over time.
But then you talk about other great things, like, you know, having fun. Like, are people having fun in their life? Are their old hobbies still nourishing them, or are their old hobbies become more work? Or, you know, what's the, you know, if the patient can't remember the last time they had fun, that's pretty serious. Because
yeah,
and then you
terrible.
Give suggestions about, you know, how people can change that.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, but really, what's the point? Why are we all here? What's the point of all this? You know, when I talk to my patients, even I ask them, well, why did you come in today, really? Is it to listen to me talk about food, or to take a supplement, or, you know, to go to the health food store and buy this or that supplement? I mean, that's not really the end point. The end point is to feel better so we can do the things we love to do. You know, whether it's be with people we want to be with and feel good about it, or do the work that that is our passion, or what. And I think sometimes that can be part of the issue, because people have gotten to a place where they're not really following their passions. They're not doing the things they love, either as hobbies or as full-time work. You know, because they're so busy in the day-to-day, you know, just trying to make ends meet, or taking care of things that they feel responsible for, and I think that can really also depress a person's mood. So it's very important at whatever level we can. I mean, I know a lot of the listeners here, we just can't quit our job, you know, tomorrow and say, I'm going to just go learn skydiving and hang out in the Bahamas. I know that's not realistic.
Yeah, exactly.
I know that's not realistic for everybody, but, you know, sometimes people can start things in small ways. You know, I have a patient who really wanted to always play guitar. And, you know, he has a wife and a family and a job, and I don't expect him to leave his job, but one thing he is doing is he's starting to take guitar lessons on the weekend.
Right.
And that, you know, and that really does fill your soul and fill your spirit and move good neurotransmitters in your brain. And that goes a long way, I think, to things like mood. So even if you can't do things like that every day and every moment, just working on them from time to time can really, I think, help the spirit move forward and get out of these things.
Get out of the funk. And, you know, with New Year's around, you know, people are making their resolutions and whatnot. And, I was doing a show on this Friday when I was on my other program with Dr. Kamai on a local Stony Brook University station, and we were talking about, you know, how to get people to keep their resolutions, because that could be a sign of depression if, you know, you can't keep your resolutions. You feel, you know, you beat yourself up about that. You know, you feel terrible. You already feel terrible that you're, you know, fat and out of shape, and or you gain 20 pounds over the holiday or whatever the situation is, but now that you've failed or feel like a failure based on your not keeping up with your resolutions, now you're beating yourself up. So a lot of I find is, my work is helping people talk a lot better to themselves. Some of depression is habitual. Like habitual negative thinking and negative self-talk. Would you agree?
Yeah. Sometimes when I give lectures or when I'm talking to patients, I was working with an 18-year-old girl, and we were talking about the messages we tell each other. And so she looked at me a little bit perplexed, and I said, it's kind of like as if your brain was a cassette player and you had a cassette that said bad messages. And she looked at me and she said, "A what?"
A cassette.
And I said, "Oh, wait a second.
You're dating yourself.
I'm obviously showing my age here, but that's really what it is. It's it's something that's in our mind, a CD, a DVD, whatever we want to say, that's saying, you wake up in the morning, it says, okay, you're not going to get anything good done today, or you're not going to be able to do everything you need to do, or it's not, And if we start the day with those kinds of messages, it really takes us down.
Yeah, now are thoughts biochemical? Is it the neurotransmitters that's causing those thoughts, or is it the thoughts that are changing the neurotransmitters? That's what I think that's very interesting. If you look at the quantum theory, and unfortunately I'm looking at the time, we're running out of time with only 2 minutes left, 2-minute warning. But
yeah, I don't think we're going to solve this. Right?
Yeah, I know, but if you look at the quantum theory, I don't know, I believe thoughts come first and then affect the biochemicals.
Like we said with the low ferritin before, sometimes if certain things in your body are off, then the thoughts are going to be affected. But of course, if we have repeating thoughts that are unhealthy, it's going to affect the physiology, biology and physiology and thoughts, and they're all wrapped into each other, and one will affect the other.
So where can people get your book and your website? Give out that information now.
Thank you for asking. Yeah, my website is www.innersourcehealth.com. That's INNERSOURCE health.com. And the book is actually innersourcehealth.com/depression.
So innersourcehealth.com/depression to get Healing Depression with Peter Bongiorno. And innersourcehealth.com is your website.
Yes.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. What a great topic to start the new year off, helping people with this problem.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for spreading good energy.
Great. And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We'll see you next week, folks. Stay healthy. Bye-bye.